of you this morning. I know there's a buzz in the air because today is commonly called Super Sunday, especially so maybe in our region because the Seahawks are playing. I hope I didn't spoil that for anybody. There's close to be 100 million people watching that game worldwide today. A ticket to get in today is now at $12,000 a ticket just to get in the gate. Seats are here are free. You come here for free. We're preoccupied by a lot of things oftentimes in our lives, and it's easy to get distracted by things, but none of them should really be allowed to intrude into this time and into our thoughts and the worship that we're able to enabled to engage in because of the sacrifice of Christ and the fellowship that we share and the edification. And so, as has been said several times this day already, and it's also in the bulletin, every Sunday is Super Sunday for us. And hope you'll read that article. I'm not the source of it. I did some changes to it. But don't read it now. Read it a little bit after I'm done. But we're glad you're here and hope that you're here not only in body but in mind and spirit as well. In our Sunday morning classes, we've been lately studying about Samuel, and we see some brief interactions between him and King Saul. And the text that we're going to be covering this morning actually goes a little further than it does. This is about where it is, 1 Samuel 13 through 22. And his life was and is the inspiration for the message this morning, which is entitled The Erosion of Sin. Webster defines erosion as the act or operation of eating or wearing away. It's a process that occurs slowly over time, gradually, day by day, year by year, the rain, the wind, glaciers slowly wear down and eat away at the surface of the earth. And the result of that is that the best of the earth is taken away. And sin is very much like that in our lives. It erodes our lives slowly and silently. It can be almost unnoticed and unseen until the damage is quite amazing. It disintegrates our lives. It steals and takes away the very best of us. And if it's allowed to continue unabated day by day and year by year, it will end up in destroying us. So if there's sin in your life, whether you accept it or recognize it or not, this erosion is occurring. And the evidence of it can generally be seen looking back over your life. How your life is characterized now compared to what it was before. And if you don't deal with it either because you're ignoring it or you thought you could control it, you'll wake up one day and the best of your life will be gone. So hopefully that awareness will not, or unawareness or ignorance of it will not be there until the end of your life. So I want to look carefully at this subject. I want to see it, first of all, in the life of Saul, and we're just going to do a whirlwind trip through the life of Saul here this morning. I've got a lot of passages. I'm not going to read all of them, but they'll be up there for you. Because he was a person who once served God. He started so well, and then you just see him deteriorating. And then I want to talk about the steps of sin, what happens in our lives that sin finally occurs in our life, and then just at the end of our lesson, we'll talk about how to deal with that. So let's begin with Saul, who started so well. In 1 Samuel, the 9th chapter, in verses 1 and 2, we have a description of him, that he was a strong, a handsome guy, a head and shoulders above everyone else. And then that we find in chapter 9, in verses 16 and 17, that he was chosen by God. God told Samuel, this is the guy. This is the one that I want you to anoint as king. And he had at least in the beginning, a natural humility. Who am I? I'm of the least tribe in Israel, of Benjamin, and my clan is the least clan and the least tribe, and I'm the least person in that. And it just a natural. He's not putting this on. This is how he really is. And yet in chapter 10 and verse 1 and in chapter 10 and verse 9, he is the one that Samuel anoints. We talked about that already in our Bible class, but God has anointed him. And immediately after doing that, in the 10th chapter in verse 26, God has moved valiant men, good men, quality men to join him, to join themselves to him. And so he's attracting these fellows. And listen, as you look at things like that, listen, we've all known people like this. Everything seems to be going their way. They're strong in whatever it is. And if they're talking about their faith, they're strong in their faith. And their life is going well. They're blessed of God in their service. They're an example to other people. And they're like the people in Galatia in chapter 5 and verse 7, in the first part of that epistle, where Paul, in writing to Galatians, said, "You started so well. You were doing so great. What's hindered you? What's happened in your life?" Because something happens. Something takes place, and it's easy to see when it's over, but it's not so easy to see at the beginning. Listen, I guarantee you, if you walk up to the Grand Canyon, you'll see it. You'll notice this great big gully, ditch, gash in the earth. But it's more difficult to see things when they just start. And perhaps seeing the erosion of sin in Saul's life will help us to get a picture of that. And of course, we could use a lot of different Bible characters, but Saul is just a good one. So in 1 Samuel, the 13th chapter, and again, I'm not going to be reading these passages, but the Philistines are attacking. Samuel has told Saul, "Here's the pattern that I want you to do. If you need me, or if we need to make sacrifice, you go to Gilgal and wait there 7 days and I'll come." And it's the seventh day and Samuel still hasn't shown up, and the people are starting to flee his army because their Philistines are without number, the text says. And so Saul says, "Bring me the sacrifices," and he offers the sacrifice. He does something he's not authorized to do, he's not supposed to do, he's not patient enough to do. And his pride and his fear led him to this disobedience that let me get back up there to the eighth, or actually this passage here, where he actually offers a sacrifice. And Samuel comes up and said, "Why did you do this foolish thing? Why did you disobey the Lord's command?" In 1 Samuel, the 14th chapter, again, he is hard-pressed by the Philistines. And we didn't cover this part in our text because this is part of Saul's life, but he, in his pride again, says, "Listen, nobody will eat anything until the Philistines are defeated, until I have avenged myself on them." You notice that I have avenged myself on them. And so he would have this victory before the people could eat. And the penalty was that if you disobey this, if you have something to eat before this battle is won, then you will die. And his rash oath then caused the people to sin, because they're so ravenous that when they finally have a victory, they take the animals, they slaughter the animals, and without cooking them even, it sounds like they're eating beef tartare, I guess. But the blood is still in the animal, and they eat the blood with the meat and cause the people to sin. His judgment is so impaired that because Jonathan, as he's going along, sees a beehive and sticks his staff into the hive and gets some honey, and it was just enough to kind of brighten his countenance that Saul noticed that and said, "You deserve to die." And he wanted to kill his own son because he violated this rash oath. And of course, the people are not going to allow that. But you can see the changes already starting to Saul. So now the point is he's just consumed with self. In 1 Samuel, the 15th chapter, in the first three verses that we looked at this morning in our study, God commands Saul to destroy utterly the Amalekites. men, women, children, infants, cows, sheep, donkeys, camels, destroy everything. And what he ended up doing, and specifically I will read verse 9, said that, but Saul and the army spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the cattle, the fat calves, the lambs, everything that was good. These they didn't destroy. They destroyed everything that was despised, but they didn't destroy those things, which was not what God said. God said, I want everything destroyed. And then there's that exchange that took place between Samuel and Saul about what he did. And Saul is saying that he certainly did do what God said. And Samuel says, why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord? And his condemnation and then given in verses 22 and 23. It's better to obey than sacrifice and hearken than the fat of rams. And because of that, your kingdom is taken away from you. And again, you see the progression. I don't have to wait. Anyone who violates my oath will die. I'm going to bring Agag back, and I'm going to bring the best back, which would, in a sense, show his strength and valor. Listen, nobody's going to allow you to take their king if you don't defeat him. And so here's the symbol of my strength and of my victory. I captured their king. It's a great sacrifice to his ego. 1 Samuel 17, you have Goliath challenging, every morning coming up and challenging the Israelite people. Put a warrior out here and let him fight me, and whoever wins, the loser's people will become the slaves of the other. The point that I want you to notice is specifically there is verse 11, where it says that on hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. If you were to describe Saul in comparison to the rest of his people, how would you describe him? He's a giant. He's head and shoulders above everyone else. And yet, he's now fearful. He's terrified. And the reason why is because his life has been eroded by sin. His relationship with God is gone. And of course he's fearful. And that's the state of a life that's eroded by sin. There's no confidence there. There's no comfort there. You don't wake up in the morning and think, well, if the Lord comes today, I'm going to heaven. You pray that he won't come today. In 1 Samuel, the 18th chapter, we find out why Saul was afraid of David. Why has fear found this place in Saul's heart with regard to David, where he's loved in the hearts of everyone else? I mean, you look at David has killed his 10,000, Saul his thousands, and there's just this, he's loved everywhere he goes. But there's fear and jealousy and hatred and bitterness in Saul's life, especially as he's looking at David. And if you look at 1 Samuel, the 19th chapter, starting at verse 11, Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and to kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, warned him, if you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed. And so Michal let David down through the window, and he fled and escaped. And Michal took an idol and laid it in the bed, covering it with garments and putting some goat's hair at the head. And when Saul sent the men to capture David, Michal said, he's ill. And they came back and said, David's ill. Saul said, you bring David back, bring the bed and him back so I can kill him right here before me. Quite a contrast to the person that we started out with. Look at 1 Samuel, the 20th chapter, in verses 32 and 33, when Jonathan is confronting his father. So why do you want to kill David? What has he done? You see Saul taking his javelin and throwing it, trying to kill his own son. He has an obsession about David. His fear is great. In fact, if you went over to 1 Samuel, the 22nd chapter, in verses 18 through 19, you'll find out there that when he finds out that a priest had helped David, that he sends Doeg the Edomite, and he kills 85 priests and their families for helping David. In 1 Samuel, the 28th chapter, any relationship that Saul had with God is completely gone. In fact, we find out there that no matter in verse 6, he doesn't speak to God through prophets. He doesn't speak to God, and God doesn't speak to him in dreams or using the high priest's Urim. There's just no answer. And so in verse 8, he turns to a medium or a witch to find out what's going on. That's not only a violation of God's law, it's a violation of Saul's own law earlier, which he made, which gives you an indication how far he is willing to go. In fact, he tells the medium, "I swear by God that you will not be harmed." Calling on God as an oath to say, "I won't harm you for doing the sin that you're about to do." He's emotionally, mentally, and spiritually empty. He's falling apart. And listen, erosion can take place in any and every relationship. And you become cynical. You can become bitter towards God. And that's exactly what we see here. And finally, of course, in 1 Samuel, the 31st chapter, this life that began so beautifully and so humbly is ruined with the pride and the jealousy and the fear and the anger and the hatred and the bitterness and all of that that's just eating at him. And he's pressed by his enemies. He's wounded by his enemies, and he calls on his armor bearer to slay him. And when the armor bearer will not, Saul falls on his own sword and commits suicide. His family is divided from him. He's turned from God. And he ends his own life. Do you think that couldn't happen to you? I mean, I hope as we're sitting here and thinking about this, say, "Oh no, I don't think that would ever happen to me." I don't care how spiritual you are or how strong you are. If sin is allowed to remain in your life, it will erode you. There's no man or woman who can allow sin to remain, who can harbor sin and nurture it and cherish it, that can stop that from occurring. It doesn't matter if you're young. It doesn't matter how old you are. Listen, Satan is in no hurry. He's willing for it to take place over a long period of time. There's a passage in, I don't have that up there, in Isaiah. I don't have the passage, I'll give it to you. It's Isaiah chapter 28 and verse 10. And a quote from the English Standard Version says, "For it is precept upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little, there a little. Thought upon thought. Action upon action that's sinful will erode your life." It happened to Saul. When we first see Saul in 1 Samuel, the 11th chapter, we would think, "No, look at this guy. Look how humble and honoring of God that he is." So let me talk to you a little bit about the seven erosive steps of sin. I've given you this adage before. You sow a thought, you reap an action. You sow an action, you reap a habit. You sow a habit, you reap a lifestyle, and you sow a lifestyle, and you reap a destiny. And you'll notice there that it starts with a thought. It starts with a thought. And in fact, the seven steps all begin in the heart. At least, initially, they begin in the heart. And the first one is, there's the entrance of a thought. The thought can be covetousness, of wanting something, of having an over desire for something. It can be anger. It can be jealousy. It can be lust. It can be bitterness. A deep-seated anger or hurt that you felt that someone did to you. It can be being unforgiving, not willing to forgive someone. It's just a thought. And really, you may have had nothing to do with it coming there. The thoughts aren't just natural, aren't always just created by us. It can happen as a result of some wrong that was done to you, or some slight that you felt was done to you. It may be placed there by someone else telling you this is what you should think about, or this is how you should. That's what I would do if that was me. It can come in a lot of different ways, and most of them are going to be external to yourself. So you have nothing to do with how the thought gets there. You have everything to do with whether it stays. Proverbs, the 4th chapter, verse 23 says, "Keep or guard your heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life." You have to protect your mind, your heart. Saul had a thought, I don't have to wait for Samuel. Just a thought. So after the thought is there, now you entertain it. You don't let it pass through. The thought comes, and you kind of hold it there, and you think about it for a while, and you don't immediately reject it as you should have done. You toy with it a little bit. Think about it a little bit more, maybe even a little bit later. And then the third step is you examine it. Boy, how would that feel to have that happen? What would that be like to do that? What would it be like to fulfill that? What would it be? How would I feel to act on that? How can I take advantage of that person? And you can talk about the fact that, well, I deserve that. I deserve to feel this way, and they deserve not to have that. And listen, in this phrase, what you're doing is you're rationalizing it, you're justifying it, you're building a case for yourself as to why this is exactly what needs to happen. And having done that, you begin to enjoy the thought. This might just be a good idea. Now we're cuddling the thought. We're getting comfortable with it. We're warming to the idea. We're fantasizing about it. We're picturing it taking place and how we can get away with it. And the process now of erosion is accelerating. It's getting faster and faster as we now begin to move towards actually committing the sin. Because now it's moved from our head to our heart. And we're liking it. The fifth phase is that we experience it. Now, up to this point, it was just a thought. Up to this point, it was all in your mind. It was just you knowing about it and God knowing about it. It's just a temptation there, but the temptation has captured you now. As James talks about. Now it becomes a reality. Now it takes the form of action and we give it life. I think right before this happens, Satan whispers in your ear and said, "Well, if you think it, you might as well do it." That's a lie. That's an absolute lie. It's true that thinking it may have been sinful. It was certainly foolish, and it's certainly dangerous. But it's not as bad for you and for others as acting on it. Doing it is far worse because, again, the erosion in your character and in your life is going to speed up. It's going to be even worse. And now others are involved. And what happens is, once you experience it, you'll soon find yourself repeating it. And repeating it. And the erosion again increases with the frequency of your sin. Listen, anything in your life, whether it's a habit, whether it's an attitude, whether it's a deed that you can see that's come this far here. And listen, if you have something in your life, you know that it's there. You know now, as we've gone through this, if you've got something in your life that's there, you can see that it's there. And you can stand back and you can see, whoa, there it is. It's there in my life. It's like looking at a mountain, and it's something that you're thinking, wow, how can I miss that? And the fact that maybe no one else knows about it. I've shared this with you before about that, my friend down in California that was an alcoholic, and he hid it. Nobody knew except his wife. And she loved going to church because he wouldn't drink before he went to church. And that was the few times in their life when he would be sober and she was happy. And we had we did an annual banquet in the congregation, and it had talent shows, and most of those kinds are talentless shows, but he was one of, every year they picked two or three couples to organize it and get it going. And he and his wife were selected one year. And he came to the banquet drunk. Just, it was so much pressure on him. And everybody knew. And then he didn't ever try to hide it again. I mean, it was out there now. And he's dead now. The fact that nobody knows about it now doesn't mean the erosion isn't taking place, because soon others will know, and then everyone will know, and then you'll have nothing to keep you, to hold it back like he did. Listen, you can't get cozy, you can't get comfortable with sin, you can't hide it, you can't tolerate it, you can't put it in safekeeping and make allowances for it in your life. Because it will ultimately destroy you. Because listen, you and I cannot handle, control sin. The sixth step is that you excuse the action, which is another thing that takes place in your mind. You become defensive about it. You tell other people to mind their own business. It's my life. I know what I'm doing. Leave me alone. Who are you to judge me? Everyone has faults. You have faults. I have these, my faults. And I justify it. You justify it. And finally, the last step is you're enveloped by it. You're consumed by it. You're committed to it. You have set your course. And at least for the time being, unless you repent, you're going to stay on that course. And listen, it takes something major in your life to get you moved now because of the simple principle of inertia, and that is an object in motion tends to stay in motion unless it's stopped by a greater force. And you pray, I pray, for me and for you, that if we're on that course, something horrible happens in our lives that will change us, that will open our eyes to the path we're on. Then we start off with, what's a little drink? What's a little gambling? What's a little affair? What's a little drug? What's a little lie? What's the big deal? What harm is there in seeing this movie or listening to this music or reading this book? The problem with it is right there. Enter the thought. Parents, you better know what your kids are listening to and what they're watching on TV and what movies or internet things that they're going to. You better know who their friends are. Which means that you're going to have to listen to them. And listen to the music that they're in. Watch the shows that they're watching. It could be just a little thought like, I just don't feel like going to church tonight. Listen, we've had families here since I've been here who, looking at them when we moved here, I would have never, they're faithful, they're active, they're teaching Bible classes, you know, their families are good and everything's going great. And then they were missing every once in a while. And it just would begin with an innocent thought, well, I'm just tired. I don't like that class or whatever it is. And it begins with just a thought, and then, so you miss. And then you begin to make plans, not to miss, but you make other plans that disallow you from coming. And listen, I don't think anybody ever makes plans to not come to services. I think what happens is they don't make plans to come to services. And the end result of that is not here at all. The family I have in mind, there's not a person in that family that's faithful anymore. If you'd have asked me 10 years ago if they would have been there where they are now, when I saw them then, I said, no way. There's not any way that they would be where they are now. If you'd ask, would Saul turn into a guy who's going to consult a medium and kill himself? When I look at him at the beginning, I said, no, there's not any way that that would happen. The way Satan works is he keeps a clear picture of the results of sin in your life from you ever seeing it. You don't, he doesn't show you how it's going to end up. A lot of you, most of you, are way too young to remember when they used to advertise cigarettes on TV. But I remember them. The ones I remember the best are Salem cigarettes, menthol, you know, and it's a young couple and they're out in the country and they're cavorting around and they're smoking their cigarettes and it's life, it's full, it's wonderful. Never saw it at a cancer ward. Or a picture of someone's lungs that have been smoking for 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years and what they look like of putting all that tar and nicotine into their lungs. Satan doesn't want you to see the end result. Same thing is true today. Now we have casinos. We have casinos everywhere. When they advertise casinos on TV, are the people having a good time? Man, it's party 24/7 there. You couldn't have a better time than that. They don't show the broken homes, the wrecked lives, the destroyed families. And if we're looking, we can pretty well see that in the lives of other people. I'll tell you where we have the difficult time seeing it in our own lives. That's the title of my lesson tonight. If you think you're standing, take heed lest you fall. When you refuse to believe what God has said about sin and the erosion of sin in your life, then you're a target for it. You're opening yourself to it. And so how do you correct it? Well, you have to be honest with yourself. You have to look at your life and recognize sin. Recognize faithlessness or lack of faith. Lack of consistency. Of being involved in things that you weren't involved in before. Of being comfortable with things that you weren't comfortable with before. And if you're a child of God, then confess that to God. Ask Him to forgive you. And if you're not a child of God, then repent of that based on your faith in Jesus Christ and be baptized in Him. And listen, in both cases, God will create you anew. You can't regain the grains of sand, the parts of your life that you've allowed sin to erode, but God can recreate it. And then you can commit to this life of service to God. And you can do what Paul said, which is you forget the things that are behind and you press on. And you trust in God. And you do the very best that you can. The lesson this morning was all about the heart. And so the question in this song, is your heart right with God? When you're singing that song, don't be singing it to everyone else. Sing it to yourself and answer the question. If we can help you in some way, please come forward while we stand and sing.